I'm VOA's Joe Ramsey with your worldwide news update. U.S. weather officials have forecast the return of high winds to Los Angeles, jeopardizing efforts to contain two massive wildfires. The National Weather Service says dry Santa Ana winds of up to 80 to 112 kilometers per hour are expected through Wednesday as the service issued its most serious fire alert, a particularly dangerous situation red flag warning beginning Tuesday. Reuters correspondent Jillian Kitchener reports.
Firefighters raced to make as much progress as they could in containing the massive wildfires burning in Los Angeles County before the return of high winds, which L.A. Mayor Karen Bass said were forecast to be severe.
The National Weather Service is predicting close to hurricane force level winds, and so we're making urgent preparations.
The Palisades Fire and the Eaton Fire have claimed the lives of at least two dozen people, leveled whole neighborhoods, and burned an area the size of Washington, D.C. L.A. County Fire Chief Anthony Maroney.
The anticipated winds combined with low humidities and low fuel moistures will keep the fire threat in all of Los Angeles County critical.
The winds threatened the hard-won progress crews have made so far. Over the weekend, firefighters beat back the Palisades fire from advancing toward the populous San Fernando Valley in the north. But officials warned the entire Los Angeles County population of nearly 10 million people to be ready to evacuate. That's in addition to the tens of thousands who have already left, with many now in shelters and flooding donation centers.
Reuters correspondent Jillian Kitchener. This is VOA News. International mediators say that Israel and Hamas are closing in on a ceasefire agreement that would halt their devastating 15-month war. AP correspondent Joe Fetterman has more from Jerusalem.
Talks have been taking place in the Qatari capital of Doha in recent days, and mediators report significant progress, though they say that some gaps still need to be bridged. The talks have been taking place on and off for months, and they're focused on a phased ceasefire agreement. The first phase would last roughly 6 weeks, and during that time, Hamas would release some of the 100 hostages it's holding in Gaza. In return, Israel would pull back troops from Palestinian population centers, allow displaced Palestinians to return to their homes, and also work with international partners to surge badly needed humanitarian aid into the territory. The idea is that this initial phase would open the door toward talks on a final ceasefire agreement. That would mean a complete end to the fighting. It would mean a complete withdrawal of Israeli troops from the territory. And it would also mean the final return of all remaining hostages, both alive and dead.
AP correspondent Joe Fetterman. U.S. President Joe Biden has less than 1 week left in office, and Biden said Monday that he's leaving President-elect Donald Trump with a nation seen as stronger and more reliable than 4 years ago. AP correspondent Sagar Magani reports.
The president says it's not just that America and its allies are stronger.
Our adversaries and competitors are weaker.
In a farewell address at the State Department, the president said he provided a strong hand when the world needed it, amid crises like the botched Afghanistan withdrawal, Russia's invasion of Ukraine, and the Israel-Hamas war.
My administration is leaving the next administration with a very strong hand to play.
Arguing his work to grow NATO and rally allied help for Ukraine, among other things, were part of a foreign policy that made the U.S. safer and economically more secure. Sagar Magani, Washington.
A U.S. federal judge said Monday the Justice Department can release Special Counsel Jack Smith's investigative report on President-elect Trump's 2020 election interference case. AP correspondent Haya Bandwani reports.
The ruling from the U.S. district judge is the latest back and forth in a court dispute over the report from the special counsel who prosecuted Trump in two cases the Justice Department abandoned in November. Earlier, the judge had temporarily blocked the department from releasing the report. Haya Bandwani, Washington.
That wraps up this update, but the world and news never stop. For additional updates, visit our website, VOAnews.com. I'm Joe Ramsey, VOA News.
Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Barty in Washington. Today is Tuesday, January 14th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Biden touts a stronger America because of his foreign policy.
Right now, in my view, thanks to our administration, the United States is winning the worldwide competition. Compared to 4 years ago, America is stronger. Our alliances are stronger. Our adversaries and competitors are weaker.
Mozambique's legislators are sworn in amid protests and boycotts. A spate of civilian killing airstrikes in Nigeria sparks concern. Former South African President Jacob Zuma gives a January 31st deadline to be reinstated as a member of the African National Congress. Doctors Without Borders suspends its activities at one of the few remaining operating hospitals in Khartoum. A rights activist links her brief kidnapping in Kenya to the Tanzanian government.
I ensure that part of the abduction was to get access to my devices and to get access to the activities that I do online, which include, of course, sometimes doing whistleblowing.
And the Kenya Radio uses its broadcast to educate indigenous communities, combat dis and misinformation. Those stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. President Joe Biden laid out his foreign policy doctrine on Monday in a sweeping speech just a week before he leaves office. He laid out his argument for staying the course just days before the return of President-elect Donald Trump, who has vowed to steer the ship in a different direction. Viewer's Anita Powell reports from the White House.
President Joe Biden boiled his 4 years of foreign policy down to this.
Right now, in my view, thanks to our administration, the United States is winning the worldwide competition. Compared to 4 years ago, America is stronger. Our alliances are stronger. Our adversaries and competitors are weaker. We have not gone to war to make these things happen.
Biden leaned heavily on multilateral institutions and norms established after World War II. He cited NATO's enlargement as an example, saying the transatlantic security bloc thwarted Russian President Vladimir Putin's plan to swallow neighboring Ukraine.
When Putin invaded Ukraine, he thought he'd conquer Kyiv in a matter of days. But the truth is, since that war began, I'm the only one that stood in the center of Kyiv, not him. Putin never has.
Biden said authoritarian players like Iran, Russia, China, and North Korea are coming together more out of weakness than out of strength. On the grinding conflict that started in Israel and has enveloped the region, he said his administration was working to put out the fires of a conflict that has raged for more than a year. He touted his work on the largest prisoner swap in modern history last year. And at the White House earlier in the day, his national security advisor pointed to progress on freeing hostages held by Hamas for more than a year. Jake Sullivan is national security advisor.
We think those details are on the brink of being fully hammered out, and the parties are right on the cusp of being able to close this deal. Whether or not we go from where we are now to actually closing it, the hours and days ahead will tell.
Analysts are looking ahead to the presidential handover. Jim Kessler is executive vice president for policy at Third Way.
It's very possible that Joe Biden's foreign policy legacy will be that he is the last president of the United States to support the world order that was created after World War II, because Donald Trump wants to remake it in a very radical way, and he may end up doing so.
Andrew Payne is a lecturer in foreign policy and security at City St. George's University of London.
This was Biden's attempt to say that diplomacy was back and that he will have a lasting imprint on U.S. foreign policy when the historians look back. I actually think that the way in which historians will remember him is probably going to be defined more by what comes next.
Biden's term ends on January 20th. Anita Powell, viewing news, the White House.
A Tanzanian human rights activist who was briefly abducted on Sunday says she was targeted because of her comments accusing the government of abusing and oppressing its people. Maria Serungi Sehai was kidnapped in Nairobi by unidentified gunmen, alarming fellow activist Mohamed Yusuf reports.
Tanzanian human rights activist Maria Serungi says she is fortunate to be free after armed men abducted her in Kenya's capital Sunday afternoon. Sarungi says she was out walking when three men grabbed her, bundled her into a vehicle and physically assaulted her as they tried to establish her identity and gain access to her mobile phone.
I ensure that the abduction, part of the abduction was to get access to my devices and to get access to the activities that I do online, which include, of course, sometimes doing whistleblowing, but also doing a lot around abductions in Tanzania. So that is the first thing that I really felt that they really wanted.
The Tanzanian, who has been living in Kenya for the past 4 years, has criticized her country's government and the ruling party for alleged human rights violations and for closing civic space for critics, journalists, opposition groups, and politicians. The armed men eventually abandoned her on a street in the dark and told her not to look back. Sarungi says she was able to secure some of her belongings and money and take a cab ride home, where she contacted family members and supporters who had posted on social media about her disappearance and had trooped to police stations trying to find her. There was no immediate comment from Tanzanian officials on the alleged abduction. Kenya has seen an increase in the abduction of foreigners in recent months. Several Turkish asylum seekers were abducted in October, and four of them were sent back to their country, a move that has angered the United Nations and rights groups. A month later, Ugandan opposition politician Kizza Besigye found himself in front of a Ugandan military court. His wife said he was kidnapped in Nairobi. Roland Ebole is an East African regional researcher at Amnesty International. He says the kidnapping trend is not good for Kenya if it wants to attract foreign businesses and diplomatic activities.
This is a very dangerous precedent to Kenya, considering that we host very many expatriates in this country. Kenya is said to become one of the largest, I think the third largest UN hub in the world. And when foreign nationals do not feel protected, they don't feel secure in this country, then this is really dangerous.
Rights groups such as Amnesty are also following up on the abduction of Kenyan government critics, a trend that started after anti-government protests in June and July that included the storming of parliament by critics of a bill to increase taxes. Despite the recent human rights violations in Kenya, Sarungi says she feels safer in Kenya than in Tanzania due to its vibrant citizens' movement for good governance, rights and the rule of law.
What I experienced yesterday, I don't know how many people know, when you have been abducted and you see people fighting for you and they don't know who you are, that gave me a sense. And later I was told that the social media Kenyans were actually trending, heated, commenting on it as if I was their own. For me, what gives me safety are the kids. The second the kids, for me, are more secure is, unlike in Tanzania, there are rule of law.
Tanzania is expected to hold a general election later this year, and rights groups and opposition groups are already predicting the government will attempt to stifle dissent and political activity. Mohamed Yusuf, VOA News, Nairobi.
Mozambique's newly elected parliament convened on Monday in the capital. This as 210 members took their oaths of office amid a boycott and protest by opposition parties who have disputed the results of the recent elections. Charles Maguiro reports from Maputo.
Armed vehicles and military police surrounded the parliament building and police blocked main roads to the area during the inauguration ceremony in the capital on Monday. Security was reinforced across Maputo, which is usually busy on a Monday morning, but was deserted with most shops closed after supporters of presidential runner-up Venancio Mondlane barricaded access to certain areas. Opposition leader Mondlane, who is popular with Mozambique's youth, assert the results were rigged in favor of the ruling Frelimo party that he has been in power for 50 years. Over the weekend, he urged his supporters to demonstrate refusal of the official election results with a national strike from Monday to Wednesday, the day President-elect Daniel Chapo is set to be inaugurated. Two smaller opposition parties, RENAMO and the Mozambique Democratic Movement, also boycotted the opening ceremony, saying they did not accept the outcome of the October election. Of the legislators who took their seats on Monday, 39 represented the Optimistic People for the Development of Mozambique, or Podemos. Another four of its members were absent. Podemos, the party that supported Mondlane, is entering the Assembly of the Republic for the first time. At the entrance to the parliament, Party leader Albino Forkiliam said Podemos stands ready to fight Frelimo's one-party rule. He says, in fact, what we are going to do today is very important. We are the first stage in which we fought against recognizing the results, and we held large protests in the country, which even resulted in many deaths, but then the results were validated. And now we understand, because of the irreversibility of these results, but also because we conform to the constitutional order, the fight moves to another stage, which is to discuss the issues here in Parliament. RENAMO, formerly the largest opposition party, now ranks third with 28 members of Parliament, while the Mozambique Democratic Movement, or MDM, holds fourth place with 8 legislators. Frelimo retains its parliamentary majority with 171 deputies, some of whom are returning members. During Monday's swearing-in ceremony, the party's senior member, Margarida Talapa, was elected parliamentary speaker. Talapa called for unity and said she intends to make the assembly an excellence of politics that promotes fruitful debates which can reach the consensus that she says the community expects for harmony, good coexistence and solidarity of all the citizens. Charles Mangwiro, VOA News, Maputo, Mozambique.
You are listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Tuesday, January 14. For more African news and features, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Connect with us on all social media platforms. We are on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Doctors Without Borders, or MSF, has suspended its activities at one of the few remaining hospitals still operating in the Sudanese capital due to ongoing violent attacks on patients and staff. Claire San Filippo is MSF Emergency Coordinator for Sudan. She tells viewers Caravan Dam that for the past 20 months, armed fighters have repeatedly entered Basile Teaching Hospital in Khartoum, demanding that their injured fighters be treated before other patients.
Bashir Hospital has provided life-saving activities. It's really devastating that we have had to stop supporting life-saving medical care at this hospital, particularly in the face of such great and growing medical needs. Every single time that an organization is forced to suspend activities, patients have less access to medical care they desperately need.
What made MSF close the hospital?
Well, unfortunately, we have experienced repeated incidents, security incidents, particularly of armed fighters entering the hospital with weapons and threatening medical staff. Very often, what we've seen is that these armed men would demand fighters to be treated before other patients. And on the 11th of November, a patient was shot dead inside the hospital. And on the 18th of December, barely 5 weeks later, attackers fired weapons inside the emergency ward, directly threatening medical staff. Luckily, no one was injured, but everyone was extremely affected, of course, by this traumatic aggression inside the hospital. Attacks against medical facilities and health personnel are absolutely unacceptable.
It's a violation of international law, isn't it?
Well, for us, it is absolutely unacceptable because hospitals must remain safe spaces where patients can come and seek access to healthcare. They're open to everyone. And this is why it's very unfortunate, but we had to take this decision to suspend medical care because it was simply untenable and the safety of our patients and our staff is paramount.
Could MSF tell who the armed men were that intruded and actually killed that man and threatened the healthcare workers?
Well, I can tell you that these were armed men in this latest incident who came into the facility and directly threatened the staff. But since the beginning of this conflict, health facilities have been looted, occupied, and shelled. Healthcare workers have been and continue to be intimidated, harassed, and assaulted. Since the beginning of the conflict, Doctors Without Borders alone, and that's only until August last year, has experienced at least 84 incidents, ranging from clashes and looting of medical supplies in hospital and warehouses to incidents related to weapons being fired in the facilities that we support. And the result of this violence is that we've been forced to suspend activities in various locations in Wad Madani, in Al Jazeera State, in Al Fashr, in North Darfur, and in Khartoum, both in the Turkish hospitals and now lately in Al Bashir hospitals.
That's Claire Sanfilippo, MSF Emergency Coordinator for Sudan. She was speaking with my colleague Carol Van Dam. Former South African President Jacob Zuma last week gave the African National Congress, the ANC, until January 31st to reinstate him as a member. Zuma was ousted from the ANC last year when he helped form and join the Umkhonto we Sizwe, or MK, party. Professor Sipho Sipe is a political analyst and a former deputy vice chancellor for institutional support at the University of Zululand. He tells me that Zuma is simply trying to be an irritant to the ANC by exposing some of its inadequacies.
Zuma feels that the ANC that he joined has been taken off its historical mission. And what he has been doing is to fight against what he considers to be the ANC of
Douglas.
Not the ANC that was started by the likes of Sol Plaatje, the ANC of Mandela, the ANC of Oliver Tambo. To that extent, there are many people who agree with him. That is why his party did so well to reduce the share of the vote of the ANC during the last election, even though the party was mere 6 months old.
Let's say, even if the ANC wanted to accept Zuma back into the party or the organization, can they do so when Zuma is the leader or the president of a new political party?
No, I don't think they would, because if they were to do so, they would be undermining their own constitution. Their constitution is very clear that the ANC will work with its alliance partners, but it will not work and tolerate any of its members to work with any other party that is competing with ANC for power. And in this case, the MK party is a party that is competing and contesting power with the ANC. So there is no doubt about the issue of misconduct. But what Zuma is doing is just wanting to prove to be an irritant. But an irritant that forces the ANC to start looking at its own processes and to look at his arguments. And when they allow him to do so, there'll be matters that he's going to raise that will challenge the political integrity of the current ANC. So he's doing this to be simply a nuisance that has a particular value to say, can you look at your leadership? Is this the leadership that is true to the historical mission of the ANC? Or is this a leadership that is captured by white capital?
One of the arguments he's making is that this expulsion was illegal because he was not given a physical hearing, rather a virtual hearing. Do you think that stands?
Well, that stands because procedurally, unless if the ANC decides to say, this is how we're going to do it, if the ANC's regulations are very clear that it must be a physical presence, there is nothing that should have prevented the ANC from hosting this in person. But what they were trying to avoid is to avoid the multitudes of supporters that will go to the ANC office to support Jacob Zuma. So the ANC is more concerned about an expression of support that the Zuma commands.
Professor Sipho Sipe is a political analyst and a former deputy vice chancellor for institutional support at the University of Zululand. He was speaking with us from Johannesburg. Human rights groups in Nigeria are condemning a pattern of civilian deaths from airstrikes in the northeast and are calling for an impartial investigation of the military's operations. This follows reports from local residents that a weekend airstrike targeting armed gangs in Zamfara State killed at least 15 civilians. Timothy Obiezu reports from Abuja.
Nigeria's Air Force has confirmed it is investigating multiple reports of civilian casualties from a Saturday raid that targeted armed gangs in northwest Zamfara state. An Air Force spokesperson, Air Vice Marshal Olusola Akinboyewa, stated Sunday that there is no confirmed evidence of civilian casualties and clarified that the airstrike targeted criminal gangs, resulting in the rescue of several people. Local residents in Tunga Kara village, however, told the news media that at least 15 people were killed, including members of a local militia. The incident follows a Christmas Day airstrike in nearby Sokoto State that killed 10 civilians. Isa Sanusi of Amnesty International condemned the frequent civilian casualties, calling them more than mere mistakes.
It is actually unfortunate that the military is repeatedly doing the same thing, striking without a proper verification of their target. It has now reached the level that they can no longer call it a mistake. The reason why the military has been doing this again and again is because the government could not hold them to account.
Amnesty International says it has received testimonies and evidence indicating that the recent airstrike in Tunga Kara killed innocent civilians. Nigerian authorities have struggled to curtail the operations of armed gangs and terror groups, often resorting to area strikes to fight them. Civilian deaths, however, have become more frequent. On Monday, Nigeria's Chief of Defense Staff, General Christopher Musa, told local media that the military does not intentionally target civilians and that an investigation into the accident is underway. Sanusi, however, insists on greater accountability.
The military should be asked to hand over all the details they have. A panel would be constituted, including experts in military air operations, so that the exact reason why this thing has been happening again and again should be confirmed so that it can be avoided in the future. Families of victims have also approached us.
Security analyst Chidi Omeje says the military must exercise caution in its aerial operations.
I'm not sure when you have this kind of intensive military operations that you always get it right. That is why, you know, I'm actually not very comfortable with the use of aerial combat in this manner, because I'm not sure we're going to the stage where we can be very precise attacks.
Since 2017, air raids by the military have resulted in the deaths of more than 400 Nigerian civilians, according to SBM Intelligence, a Lagos-based research firm. Timothy Obiezu, VOA News, Abuja, Nigeria.
And that's it for this Tuesday, January 14th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for spending your morning with us. For more Africa news and features, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Connect with us on all social media platforms. We are on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. We are also on YouTube, where you can watch our TV shows, Africa 54, Straight Talk Africa, and Red Carpet. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, I'm James Barton in Washington, saying thank you for listening.
Of America on January 20th for comprehensive coverage of the presidential inauguration ceremonies as President-elect Donald John Trump takes the oath of office. From live reporting to expert analysis, VOA brings you every moment as history unfolds. Stay informed, stay connected, only on The Voice of America. Monday, January 20th, the 47th President of the United States, Donald John Trump, will be sworn into office. VOA will be there and will broadcast the events of the presidential inauguration live, starting at 1600 UTC to audiences around the world.
I pledge that I will be president for all Americans.
Tune in.